Chapter 3. The Priest's Tale, New York. 1. It was the drink. That was what he came to believe when he finally stopped it, and clarity came. Not God, not Satan, not some deep psychosexual battle between his blessed mither and his blessed da, just the drink. And was it surprising that whiskey should have taken him by the ears? He was Irish, he was a priest. One more strike and you're out. From seminary in Boston, he'd gone to a city parish in Lowell, Massachusetts. His parishioners had loved him. He wouldn't refer to them as his flock. Flocks were what you called seagulls on their way to the town dump. But after 7 years in Lowell, Callahan had grown uneasy. When talking to Bishop Dugan in the diocese office, he had used all the correct buzzwords of the time to express this unease. Anomie, urban malaise, an increasing lack of empathy, a sense of disconnection from the life of the spirit. He'd had a nip in the bathroom before his appointment, followed by a couple of wintergreen lifesavers, no fool he, and had been particularly eloquent that day. Eloquence does not always proceed from belief, but often proceeds from the bottle. And he was no liar. He had believed what he was saying that day in Dugan's study, every word. As he believed in Freud, the future of the mass spoken in English, the nobility of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, and the idiocy of his widening war in Vietnam, waist deep in the wide muddy, and the big fool said to push on, as the old folk tune had it. He believed in large part because those ideas, if they were ideas and not just cocktail party chatter, had been currently trading high on the intellectual big board. Social conscience is up 2 1/3, hearth and home down 1/4, but still your basic blue-chip stock. Later, it all became simpler. Later, he came to understand that he wasn't drinking too much because he was spiritually unsettled, but spiritually unsettled because he was drinking too much. You wanted to protest, to say that couldn't be it, or not just that, it was too simple. But it was that. Just that. God's voice is still and small, the voice of a sparrow in a cyclone, so said the prophet Isaiah, and we all say thank you. It's hard to hear a small voice clearly if you're shit-ass drunk most of the time. Callahan left America for Roland's World before the computer revolution spawned the acronym GIGO, Garbage In, Garbage Out. But in plenty of time to hear someone at an AA meeting observe that if you put an asshole on a plane in San Francisco and flew him to the East Coast, the same asshole got off in Boston, usually with 4 or 5 drinks under his belt, but that was later. In 1964, he had believed what he believed, and plenty of people had been anxious to help him find his way. From Lowell, he had gone to Spofford, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton. There he stayed for 5 years, and then he began to feel restless again. Consequently, he began to talk the talk again, the kind the diocesan office listened to, the kind that got you moved on down the line. Anomie, spiritual disconnection, this time from his suburban parishioners. Yes, they liked him and he liked them, but something still seemed to be wrong. And there was something wrong, mostly in the quiet bar on the corner where everybody also liked him, and in the liquor cabinet in the rectory living room. Beyond small doses, alcohol is a toxin. And Callahan was poisoning himself on a nightly basis. It was the poison in his system, not the state of the world or that of his own soul, which was bringing him down. Had it always been that obvious? Later, at another AA meeting, he'd heard a guy refer to alcoholism and addiction as the elephant in the living room. How could you miss it? Callahan hadn't told him. He'd still been in the first 90 days of sobriety at that point, and that meant he was supposed to just sit there and be quiet. Take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth, the old-timers advised, and we all say thank you. But he could have told him, yes, indeed, you could miss the elephant if it was a magic elephant, if it had the power, like the shadow, to cloud men's minds. To actually make you believe that your problems were spiritual and mental, but absolutely not boozical. Good Christ, just the alcohol-related loss of the REM sleep was enough to screw you up righteously, but somehow you never thought of that while you were active. Booze turned your thought processes into something akin to that circus routine where all the clowns come piling out of the little car. When you looked back in sobriety, The things you'd said and done made you wince. I'd sit in a bar solving all the problems of the world, then not be able to find my car in the parking lot, one fellow at a meeting remembered, and we all say thank you. The things you thought were even worse. How could you spend the morning puking and the afternoon believing you were having a spiritual crisis? Yet he had. And his superiors had, possibly because more than a few of them were having their own problems with the magic elephant. Callahan began thinking that a smaller church, a rural parish, would put him back in touch with God and himself. And so, in the spring of 1969, he found himself in New England again. Northern New England this time. He had set up shop, bag and baggage, crucifix and chasuble, in the pleasant little town of Jerusalem's Lot, Maine. There, he had finally met real evil, looked it in the face, and flinched. 2. A writer came to me, he said. A man named Ben Mears. I think I read one of his books, Eddie said. Air Dance, it was called. About a man who gets hung for the murder his brother committed? Callahan nodded. That's the one. There was also a teacher named Matthew Burke, and they both believed there was a vampire at work in Salem's Lot. The kind who makes other vampires. Is there any other kind? Eddie asked. Remembering about 100 movies of the Majestic and maybe 1,000 comic books purchased at and sometimes stolen from Dolly's. There is, and we'll get there, but never mind that now. Most of all, there was a boy who believed he was about the same age as your Jake. They didn't convince me, not at first, but they were convinced, and it was hard to stand against their belief. Also, something was going on in the lot, that much was certain. People were disappearing. There was an atmosphere of terror in the town. Impossible to describe it now, sitting here in the sun, but it was there. I had to officiate at the funeral of another boy. His name was Daniel Gleck. I doubt he was this vampire's first victim in the lot, and he certainly wasn't the last, but he was the first one who turned up dead. On the day of Danny Glick's burial, my life changed somehow. And I'm not talking about the quart of whiskey a day anymore, either. Something changed in my head. I felt it. Like a switch turning. And although I haven't had a drink in years, that switch is still turned. Susanna thought, that's when you went toe-dash, Father Callahan. Eddie thought, that's when you went 19, pal, or maybe it's 99, or maybe it's both somehow. Roland simply listened. His mind was clear of reflection, a perfect receiving machine. The writer Mears had fallen in love with a town girl named Susan Norton. The vampire took her. I believe he did it partly because he could, and partly to punish Mears for daring to form a group, a quartet, that would try to hunt him. We went to the place the vampire had bought, an old wreck called the Marston House. The thing staying there went by the name of Barlow. Callahan sat, considering, looking through them and back to those old days. At last he resumed. Barlow was gone, but he'd left the woman and a letter. It was addressed to all of us, but was directed principally to me. The moment I saw her lying there in the cellar of the Marston House, I understood it was all true. The doctor with us listened to her chest and took her blood pressure, though, just to be sure. No heartbeat, blood pressure zero. But when Ben pounded the stake into her, she came alive. The blood flowed. She screamed over and over. Her hands, I remembered the shadows of her hands on the wall. Eddie's hand gripped Susanna's. They listened in a horrified suspension that was neither belief nor disbelief. This wasn't a talking train powered by malfunctioning computer circuits, nor men and women who had reverted to savagery. This was something akin to the unseen demon that had come to the place where they had drawn Jake, or the doorkeeper in Dutch Hill. "What did he say to you in his note, this Barlow?" Roland asked.
"That my faith was weak, and I would undo myself. He was right, of course. By then, the only thing I really believed in was Bushmills. I just didn't know it. He did, though. Booze is also a vampire, and maybe it takes one to know one. The boy who was with us became convinced that this prince of vampires meant to kill his parents next, or turn them, for revenge. The boy had been taken prisoner, you see, but he escaped and killed the vampire's half-human accomplice, a man named Straker.
Roland nodded, thinking this boy sounded more and more like Jake. What was his name?
Mark Petrie. I went with him to his house, and with all the considerable power my church affords, the cross, the stole, the holy water, and of course the Bible. But I had come to think of these things as symbols, and that was my Achilles heel. Barlow was there. He had Petrie's parents. And then he had the boy. I held up my cross. It glowed. It hurt him. He screamed.
Callahan smiled, recalling that scream of agony. The look of it chilled Eddie's heart.
I told him that if he hurt Mark, I'd destroy him. And at that moment, I could have done it. He knew it, too. His response was that before I did, he'd rip the child's throat out. And he could have done it. Mexican standoff. Eddie murmured, remembering a day by the Western Sea when he had faced Roland in a strikingly similar situation. Mexican standoff, baby.
What happened? Susanna asked. Callahan's smile faded. He was rubbing his scarred right hand the way the gunslinger had rubbed his hip without seeming to realize it.
The vampire made a proposal. He would let the boy go if I'd put down the crucifix I held. We'd face each other unarmed, his faith against mine. I agreed. God help me, I agreed. The boy.
3. The boy is gone, like an eddy of dark water. Barlow seems to grow taller. His hair, swept back from his brow in the European manner, seems to float around his skull. He's wearing a dark suit and a bright red tie, impeccably knotted, and to Callahan, he seems part of the darkness that surrounds him. Mark Petrie's parents lie dead at his feet, their skulls crushed.
Fulfill your part of the bargain, Shaman.
But why should he? Why not drive him off, settle for a draw this night, or kill him outright? Something is wrong with the idea, terribly wrong, but he cannot pick out just what it is. Nor will any of the buzzwords that have helped him in previous moments of crisis be of any help to him here. This isn't anime, lack of empathy, or the existential grief of the 20th century. This is a vampire and
his cross, which had been glowing fiercely, is growing dark. Fear leaps into his belly, like a confusion of hot wires. Barlow is walking toward him across the Petrie kitchen, and Callahan can see the thing's fangs very clearly because Barlow is smiling. It is a winner's smile. Callahan takes a step backward, then two, then his buttocks strike the edge of the table, and the table pushes back against the wall, and then there is nowhere left to go.
Sad to see a man's faith fail, says Barlow, and reaches out.
Why should he not reach out? The cross Callahan is holding up is now dark. Now it's nothing but a piece of plaster, a cheap piece of rickrack his mother bought in a Dublin souvenir shop, probably at a scalper's price. The power it had sent ramming up his arm, enough spiritual voltage to smash down walls and shatter stone, is gone. Barlow plucks it from his fingers. Callahan cries out miserably, the cry of a child who suddenly realizes the boogeyman has been real all along, waiting patiently in the closet for its chance. And now comes a sound that will haunt him for the rest of his life. From New York and the secret highways of America, to the AA meetings in Topeka, where he finally sobered up, to the final stop in Detroit, to his life here in Calabrine Sturgis. He will remember that sound when his forehead is scarred and he fully expects to be killed. He will remember it when he is killed. The sound is two dry snaps as Barlow breaks the arms of the cross, and the meaningless thump as he throws what remains on the floor. And he'll also remember the cosmically ludicrous thought which came even as Barlow reached for him.
God, I need a drink.
4. The pair looked at Roland, Eddie, and Susanna with the eyes of one who is remembering the absolute worst moment of his life.
You hear all sorts of sayings and slogans in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's one that recurs to me whenever I think of that night. Of Barlow taking hold of my shoulders.
What? Eddie asked.
Be careful what you pray for, Callahan said, because you just might get it.
You got your drink, Roland said.
Oh, yes, Callahan said. I got my drink.
5. Barlow's hands are strong, implacable. As Callahan is drawn forward, he suddenly understands what's going to happen. Not death. Death would be a mercy compared to this. No, please, no, he tries to say, but nothing comes out of his mouth but one small, whipped moan.
Now, priest,
the vampire whispers. Callahan's mouth is pressed against the reeking flesh of the vampire's cold throat. There is no enemy, no social dysfunction, no ethical or racial ramifications, only the stink of death and one vein, open and pulsing with Barlow's dead-infected blood. No sense of existential loss, no postmodern grief for the death of the American value system, not even the religio-psychological guilt of Western man. Only the effort to hold his breath forever, or twist his head away, or both. He cannot. He holds on for what seems like eons, smearing the blood across his cheeks and forehead and chin like war paint, to no avail. In the end, he does what all alcoholics must do once the booze has taken them by the ears. He drinks. Strike 3. You're out.
6. The boy got away. There was that much. And Barlow let me go. Killing me wouldn't have been any fun, would it? No. The fun was in letting me live. I wandered for an hour or more through a town that was less and less there. There aren't many Type 1 vampires, and that's a blessing because a Type 1 can cause one hell of a lot of mayhem in an extremely short period of time. The town was already half infected, but I was too blind, too shocked to realize it. And none of the new vampires approached me. Barlow had set his mark on me as surely as God set his mark on Cain before sending him off to dwell in the land of Nod. His watch and his warrant, as you'd say, Roland. There was a drinking fountain in the alley beside Spencer's Drugs, the sort of thing no public health office would have sanctioned a few years later, but back then, there was one or two in every small town. I washed Barlow's blood off my face and neck there. Tried to wash it out of my hair, too. And then I went to St. Andrew's, my church. I'd made up my mind to pray for a second chance. Not to the God of the theologians who believe that everything holy and unholy ultimately comes from inside us, but to the old God, the one who proclaimed to Moses that he should not suffer a witch to live, and gave unto his own son the power to raise from the dead. A second chance is all I wanted. My life for that. By the time I got to St. Andrew's, I was almost running. There were 3 doors going inside. I reached for the middle one. Somewhere a car backfired and someone laughed. I remember those sounds very clearly. It's as if they marked the border of my life as a priest of the Holy Roman Catholic Church.
What happened to you, Sugar? Susanna asked.
The door rejected me, Callahan said. It had an iron handle, and when I touched it, fire came out of it like a reverse stroke of lightning. It knocked me all the way down the steps and onto the cement path. It did this. He raised his scarred right hand. And that? Eddie asked, and pointed to his forehead. No, Callahan said. That came later. I picked myself up, walked some more, wound up at Spencer's again, only this time I went in, bought a bandage for my hand, and then, while I was paying, I saw the sign, Ride the Big Gray Dog.
He means greyhound, Sugar, Susanna told Roland. It's a nationwide bus company.
Roland nodded and twirled a finger in his go-on gesture.
Miss Coogan told me the next bus went to New York, so I bought a ticket on that one. If she'd told me it went to Jacksonville or Nome or Hot Burgoo, South Dakota, I would have gone to one of those places. All I wanted to do was get out of that town,
I didn't care that people were dying and worse than dying, some of them my friends, some of them my parishioners. I just wanted to get out. Can you understand that?
Yes, Roland said with no hesitation. Very well.
Callahan looked into his face, and what he saw there seemed to reassure him a little. When he continued, he seemed calmer.
Loretta Coogan was one of the town spinsters. I must have frightened her because she said I'd have to wait for the bus outside. I went out. Eventually the bus came. I got on and gave the driver my ticket. He took his half and gave me my half. I sat down. The bus started to roll. We went under the flashing yellow blinker at the middle of town, and that was the first mile. The first mile on the road that took me here. Later on, maybe 4:30 in the morning, still dark outside, the bus stopped in...
7.
Hartford, the bus driver says. This is Hartford, Mac. We got a 20-minute rest stop. You want to go in and get a sandwich or something?
Callahan fumbles his wallet out of his pocket with his bandaged hand and almost drops it. The taste of death is in his mouth, a moronic, mealy taste like a spoiled apple. He needs something to take away that taste, and if nothing will take it away, something to change it. And if nothing will change it, at least something to cover it up, the way you might cover up an ugly gouge in a wood floor with a piece of cheap carpet. He holds out a 20 to the bus driver and says, "Can you get me a bottle?
Mister, the rules, and keep the change, of course. A pint would be fine. I don't need nobody cutting up on my bus. We'll be in New York in 2 hours. You can get anything you want once we're there."
The bus driver tries to smile.
"It's Fun City, you know."
Callahan, he's no longer Father Callahan, the flash of fire from the door handle answered that question at least, adds a 10 to the 20. Now he's holding out $30. Again, he tells the driver a pint would be fine, and he doesn't expect any change. This time, the driver, not an idiot, takes the money.
"But don't you go cutting up on me," he repeats. "I don't need nobody cutting up on my bus."
Callahan nods.
"No cutting up. That's a big 10-4.
The driver goes into the combination grocery store, liquor store, short order restaurant that exists here on the rim of Hartford, on the rim of morning, under yellow high-intensity lights. There are secret highways in America, highways in hiding. This place stands at one of the entrance ramps leading into that network of dark side roads, and Callahan senses it. It's in the way the Dixie cups and crumpled cigarette packs blow across the tarmac in the pre-dawn wind. It whispers from the sign on the gas pumps, the one that says, "Pay for gas in advance after sundown." It's in the teenage boy across the street, sitting on a porch stoop at 4:30 in the morning, with his head in his arms, a silent essay in pain. The secret highways are out close, and they whisper to him. "Come on, buddy," they say. "Here is where you can forget everything. Even the name they tied on you when you were nothing but a naked, blatting baby, still smeared with your mother's blood. They tied a name to you like a can to a dog's tail, didn't they? But you don't need to drag it around here. Come. Come on." But he goes nowhere. He's waiting for the bus driver, and pretty soon the bus driver comes back, and he's got a pint of Old Log Cabin in a brown paper sack. This is a brand Callahan knows well. A pint of the stuff probably goes for $2.25 out here in the boonies, which means the bus driver has just earned himself a $28 tip, give or take. Not bad. But it's the American way, isn't it? Give a lot to get a little. And if the log cabin will take that terrible taste out of his mouth, much worse than the throbbing in his burned hand, it'll be worth every penny of the $30. Hell, it would be worth a C-note.
"No cutting up," the driver says. "I'll put you out right in the middle of the Cross Bronx Expressway if you start cutting up. I swear to God I will."
By the time the Greyhound pulls into the Port Authority, Don Callahan is drunk. But he doesn't cut up. He simply sits quietly until it's time to get off and join the flow of 6 o'clock humanity under the cold fluorescent lights. The junkies, the cabbies, the shoeshine boys, the girls who'll blow you for $10, the boys dressed up as girls who'll blow you for $5, the cops twirling their nightsticks, the dope dealers carrying their transistor radios, the blue-collar guys who are just coming in from New Jersey. Callahan joins them, drunk, but quiet.
The nightstick-twirling cops do not give him so much as a second glance. The Port Authority air smells of cigarette smoke and joysticks and exhaust. The docked buses rumble. Everyone here looks cut loose. Under the cold white fluorescence, they all look dead. No, he thinks, walking under a sign reading to street. Not dead, that's wrong. Undead, 8. Man, Eddie said, you've been to the wars, haven't you? Greek, Roman, and Vietnam. When the old fellow began, Eddie had been hoping he'd gallop through his story so they could go into the church and look at whatever was stashed there. He hadn't expected to be touched, let alone shaken. But he had been. Callahan knew stuff Eddie thought no one else could possibly know. The sadness of Dixie cups rolling across the pavement, the rusty hopelessness of that sign on the gas pumps, the look of the human eye in the hour before dawn. Most of all, about how sometimes you had to have it.
The wars? I don't know, Callahan said. Then he sighed and nodded. Yes, I suppose so. I spent that first day in movie theaters and that first night in Washington Square Park. I saw that the other homeless people covered themselves up with newspapers, so that's what I did. And here's an example of how life, the quality of life and the texture of life, seemed to have changed for me, beginning on the day of Danny Glick's burial. You won't understand right away, but bear with me.
He looked at Eddie and smiled.
And don't worry, son. I'm not going to talk the day away, or even the morning.
You go on and tell it any old way it does you fine, Eddie said. Callahan burst out laughing.
Say thank you. I say thank you big. What I was going to tell you is that I'd covered my top half with the Daily News, and the headline said, Hitler Brothers Strike in Queens.
Oh, my God, the Hitler Brothers, Eddie said. I remember them, couple of morons. They beat up, what, Jews, blacks?
Both, Callahan said, and carved swastikas on their foreheads. They didn't have a chance to finish mine, which is good because what they had in mind after the cutting was a lot more than a simple beating. And that was years later, when I came back to New York.
Swastika, Roland said. The sigil on the plane we found near River Crossing? The one with David Quick inside it?
Uh-huh, Eddie said, and drew one in the grass with the toe of his boot.
The grass sprang up almost immediately, but not before Roland saw that, yes, the mark on Callahan's forehead could have been meant to be one of those, if it had been finished.
On that day, in late October of 1975, Callahan said, the Hitler brothers were just a headline I slept under. I spent most of that second day in New York walking around and fighting the urge to score a bottle. There was part of me that wanted to fight instead of drink, to try and atone. At the same time, I could feel Barlow's blood working into me, getting in deeper and deeper. The world smelled different and not better. Things looked different and not better, and the taste of him came creeping back into my mouth, a taste like dead fish or rotten wine. I had no hope of salvation. Never think it, but atonement isn't about salvation anyway, not about heaven. It's about clearing your conscience here on earth. And you can't do it drunk. I didn't think of myself as an alcoholic, not even then, but I did wonder if he'd turned me into a vampire. If the sun would start to burn my skin, and I'd start looking at ladies' necks. He shrugged, laughed. Or maybe gentlemen's. You know what they say about the priesthood. We're just a bunch of closet queers running around and shaking the cross in people's faces.
But you weren't a vampire, Eddie said.
Not even a type 3. Nothing but unclean. On the outside of everything, cast away. Always smelling his stink, and always seeing the world the way things like him must see it, in shades of gray and red. Red was the only bright color I was allowed to see for years. Everything else was just a whisper. I guess I was looking for a manpower office, you know, the day labor company. I was still pretty rugged in those days, and of course I was a lot younger as well. I didn't find manpower. What I did find was a place called Home. This was on First Avenue and 47th Street, not far from the UN.
Roland, Eddie, and Susanna exchanged a look. Whatever home was, it had existed only 2 blocks from the vacant lot. Only it wouldn't have been vacant back then, Eddie thought. Not back in 1975. In 75, it would still have been Tom and Jerry's artistic deli, party platters our specialty. He suddenly wished Jake were here. Eddie thought that by now the kid would have been jumping up and down with excitement. What kind of shop was home? Roland asked.
Not a shop at all. A shelter. A wet shelter. I can't say for sure that it was the only one in Manhattan, but I bet it was one of the very few. I didn't know much about shelters then, just a little bit from my first parish, but as time went by, I learned a great deal. I saw the system from both sides. There were times when I was the guy who ladled out the soup at 6 p.m. and passed out the blankets at 9, at other times I was the guy who drank the soup and slept under the blankets. After a head check for lice, of course. There are shelters that won't let you in if they smell booze on your breath. And there are ones where they'll let you in if you claim you're at least 2 hours downstream from your last drink. There are places, a few, that'll let you in pissy-ass drunk, as long as they can search you at the door and get rid of all your hooch. Once that's taken care of, they put you in a special locked room with the rest of the low-bottom guys. You can't slip out to get another drink if you change your mind, and you can't scare the folks who are less soaked than you are if you get the DTs and start seeing bugs come out of the walls. No women allowed in the lockup. They're too apt to get raped. It's just one of the reasons more homeless women die in the streets than homeless men. That's what Lupe used to say.
Lupe? Eddie asked.
I'll get to him, but for now, suffice it to say that he was the architect of home's alcohol policy. At home, they kept the booze in lockup, not the drunks. You could get a shot if you needed one, and if you promised to be quiet, plus a sedative chaser. This isn't recommended medical procedure. I'm not even sure it was legal, since neither Lupe nor Rowan Magruder were doctors, but it seemed to work. I came in sober on a busy night, and Lupe put me to work. I worked free for the first couple of days, and then Rowan called me into his office, which was roughly the size of a broom closet. He asked me if I was an alcoholic. I said no. He asked me if I was wanted by the police. I said no. He asked if I was on the run from anything. I said yes, from myself. He asked me if I wanted to work, and I started to cry. He took that as a yes. I spent the next 9 months, until June of 1976, working at home. I made the beds, I cooked in the kitchen, I went on fundraising calls with Lupe or sometimes Rowan. I took drunks to AA meetings in the home van, I gave shots of booze to guys that were shaking too badly to hold the glasses themselves. I took over the books because I was better at it than Magruder or Lupe or any of the other guys who worked there. Those weren't the happiest days of my life. I'd never go that far. And the taste of Barlow's blood never left my mouth, but they were days of grace. I didn't think a lot. I just kept my head down and did whatever I was asked to do. I started to heal. Sometime during that winter, I realized that I'd started to change. It was as if I developed a kind of sixth sense. Sometimes I heard chiming bells, horrible yet at the same time sweet. Sometimes, when I was on the street, things would start to look dark even if the sun was shining. I can remember looking down to see if my shadow was still there. I'd be positive it wouldn't be, but it always was.
Roland's quartet exchanged a glance.
Sometimes there was an olfactory element to these fugues. It was a bitter smell, like strong onions all mixed with hot metal. I began to suspect that I had developed a form of epilepsy.
Did you see a doctor? Susanna asked.
I did not. I was afraid of what else he might find. A brain tumor seemed most likely. What I did was keep my head down and keep working. And then one night, I went to a movie in Times Square. It was a revival of 2 Clint Eastwood westerns, what they used to call spaghetti westerns.
Yeah, Eddie said.
I started hearing the bells, the chimes, and smelling that smell stronger than ever. All this was coming from in front of me, and to the left, I looked there and saw 2 men, one rather elderly, the other younger. They were easy enough to pick out because the place was 3/4 empty.
The younger man leaned close to the older man. The older man never took his eyes off the screen, but he put his arm around the younger man's shoulders. If I'd seen that on any other night, I would have been pretty positive what was going on, but not that night. I watched, and I started to see a kind of dark blue light. First, just around the younger man, then around both of them. It was like no other light I'd ever seen. It was like the darkness I felt sometimes on the street when the chimes started to play in my head, like the smell. You knew those things weren't there, and yet they were. And I understood. I didn't accept it. That came later, but I understood. The younger man was a vampire.
He stopped, thinking about how to tell his tale, how to lay it out.
I believe there are at least three types of vampires at work in our world. I call them types 1, 2, and 3. Type 1s are rare. Barlow was a type 1. They live very long lives and may spend extended periods, 50 years, 100, maybe 200, in deep hibernation. When they're active, they're capable of making new vampires, what we call the undead. These undead are type 2s. They are also capable of making new vampires, but they aren't cunning.
He looked at Eddie and Susanna.
Have you seen Night of the Living Dead?
Susanna shook her head. Eddie nodded.
The undead in that movie were zombies, utterly brain dead. Type 2 vampires are more intelligent than that, but not much. They can't go out during the daylight hours. If they try, they are blinded, badly burned, or killed. Although I can't say for sure, I believe their lifespans are usually short. Not because the change from living and human to undead and vampire shortens life, but because the existences of type 2 vampires are extremely perilous. In most cases, this is what I believe, not what I know, type 2 vampires create other type 2 vampires in a relatively small area. By this phase of the disease, and it is a disease, the type 1 vampire, the king vampire, has usually moved on. In Salem's Lot, they actually killed the son of a bitch, one of what might have been only a dozen in the entire world. In other cases, type 2s create type 3s. Type 3s are like mosquitoes. They can't create more vampires, but they can feed and feed and feed.
Do they catch AIDS? Eddie asked. I mean, you know what that is, right?
I know. Although I never heard the term until the spring of 1983, when I was working at the Lighthouse Shelter in Detroit, and my time in America had grown short. Of course, we'd known for almost 10 years that there was something. Some of the literature called it GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. In 1982, there started to be newspaper articles about a new disease called gay cancer, and speculations that it might be catching. On the street, some of the men called it fucksore disease, after the blemishes it left. I don't believe that vampires die of it or even get sick from it, but they can have it, and they can pass it on. Oh, yes, and I have reason to think that.
Callahan's lips quivered, then firmed.
When this vampire demon made you drink his blood, he gave you the ability to see these things, Roland said.
Yes.
All of them, or just the 3s? The little ones?
The little ones, Callahan mused, then voiced a brief and humorless laugh. Yes, I like that. In any case, 3s are all I've ever seen, at least since leaving Jerusalem's Lot. But of course, type 1s like Barlow are very rare, and type 2s don't last long. Their very hunger undoes them. They're always ravenous. Type 3s, however, can go out in daylight, and they take their principal sustenance from food, just as we do.
What did you do that night? Susanna asked.
In the theater. Nothing, Callahan said. My whole time in New York, my first time in New York, I did nothing until April. I wasn't sure, you see. I mean, my heart was sure, but my head refused to go along, and all the time there was interference from the most simple thing of all. I was a dry alcoholic. An alcoholic is also a vampire, and that part of me was getting thirstier and thirstier, while the rest of me was trying to deny my essential nature. So I told myself I'd seen a couple of homosexuals canoodling in the movies, nothing more than that. As for the rest of it, the chimes, the smell, the dark blue light around the young one,
I convinced myself it was epilepsy, or a holdover from what Barlow had done to me, or both. And of course about Barlow I was right. His blood was awake inside me. It saw.
It was more than that, Roland said.
Callahan turned to him.
You went Todash, Pear. Something was calling you from this world, the thing in your church, I suspect, although it would not have been in your church when you first knew of it.
No,
Callahan said.
He was regarding Roland with wary respect.
It was not. How do you know? Tell me, I beg.
Roland did not. Go on, he said. What happened to you next?
Lupe happened next, Callahan said.
9. His last name was Delgado. Roland registered only a moment of surprise at this, a widening of the eyes. But Eddie and Susanna knew the gunslinger well enough to understand that even this was extraordinary. At the same time, they had become almost used to these coincidences that could not possibly be coincidences, to the feeling that each one was the click of some great turning cog. Lupe Delgado was 32, an alcoholic almost 5 one-day-at-a-time years from his last drink, and had been working at home since 1974. Magruder had founded the place, but it was Lupe Delgado who invested it with real life and purpose. During his days, he was part of the maintenance crew at the Plaza Hotel on Fifth Avenue. Nights, he worked at the shelter. He had helped to craft Holmes' wet policy and had been the first person to greet Callahan when he walked in.
I was in New York a little over a year that first time, Callahan said. But by March of 1976, I had...
He paused, struggling to say what all three of them understood from the look on his face. His skin had flushed rosy except for where the scar lay. That seemed to glow an almost preternatural white by comparison.
Oh, okay, I suppose you'd say that by March I'd fallen in love with him. Does that make me a queer? A faggot? I don't know. They say we all are, don't they? Some do anyway, and why not? Every month or two there seemed to be another story in the paper about a priest with a penchant for sticking his hand up the altar boy's skirts. As for myself, I had no reason to think of myself as queer. God knows I wasn't immune to the turn of a pretty female leg, priest or not, and molesting the altar boys never crossed my mind. Nor was there ever anything physical between Lupe and me. But I loved him. And I'm not just talking about his mind or his dedication or his ambitions for home, not just because he'd chosen to do his real work among the poor like Christ, either. There was a physical attraction.
Callahan paused, struggled, then burst out,
God, he was beautiful. Beautiful.
What happened to him? Roland asked.
He came in one snowy night in late March. The place was full, and the natives were restless. There had already been one fistfight, and we were still picking up from that. There was a guy with a full-blown fit of the DTs, and Rowan Magruder had him in back in his office, feeding him coffee laced with whiskey. As I think I told you, we had no lock-up room at home. It was dinner time, half an hour past, actually, and three of the volunteers hadn't come in because of the weather. The radio was on and a couple of women were dancing. Feeding time in the zoo, Lupe used to say. I was taking off my coat, heading for the kitchen. This fellow named Frank Spinelli collared me, wanted to know about a letter of recommendation I'd promised to write him. There was a woman, Lisa, somebody, who wanted help with one of the AA steps, made a list of those we had harmed. There was a young guy who wanted help with a job application. He could read a little but not write. Something starting to burn on the stove, complete confusion. And I liked it. It had a way of sweeping you up and carrying you along. But in the middle of it all, I stopped. There were no bells, and the only aromas were drunks, B.O., and burning food. But that light was around Lupe's neck, like a collar. And I could see marks there, just little ones. No more than nips, really. I stopped, and I must have reeled, because Lupe came hurrying over, and then I could smell it. Just faintly. Strong onions and hot metal. I must have lost a few seconds, too, because all at once the two of us were in the corner by the filing cabinet where we keep the AA stuff, and he was asking me when I last ate. He knew I sometimes forgot to do that. The smell was gone. The blue glow around his neck was gone, and those little nips, where something had bitten him, they were gone, too. Unless the vampire's a real guzzler, the marks go in a hurry. But I knew. It was no good asking him who he'd been with, or when, or where. Vampires, even type threes, especially type threes, maybe, have their protective devices. Pond leeches secrete an enzyme in their saliva that keeps the blood flowing while they're feeding. It also numbs the skin, so unless you actually see the thing on you, you don't know what's happening. With these type 3 vampires, it's as if they carry a kind of selective, short-term amnesia in their saliva. I passed it off somehow, told him I'd just felt lightheaded for a second or two, blamed it on coming out of the cold and into all the noise and light and heat. He accepted it, but told me I had to take it easy. "You're too valuable to lose, Don," he said. And then he kissed me. "Here." Callahan touched his right cheek with his scarred right hand. "So I guess I lied when I said there was nothing physical between us, didn't I? There was that one kiss. I can still remember exactly how it felt. Even the little prickle of fine stubble on his upper lip. Here."
"I am so very sorry for you," Susanna said.
"Thank you, my dear," he said. "I wonder if you know how much that means. How wonderful it is to have condolence from one's own world. It's like being a castaway and getting news from home or fresh water from a spring after years of stale bottled stuff."
He reached out, took her hand in both of his, and smiled. To Eddie, something in that smile looked forced or even false. And he had a sudden, ghastly idea. What if Pear Callahan was smelling a mixture of bitter onions and hot metal right now? What if he was seeing a blue glow not around Susanna's neck like a collar, but around her stomach, like a belt? Eddie looked at Roland, but there was no help there. The gunslinger's face was expressionless.
"He had AIDS, didn't he?" Eddie asked. "Some gay type 3 vampire bit your friend and passed it on to him."
"Gay," Callahan said. "Do you mean to tell me that stupid word actually—" He trailed off, shaking his head.
"Yep," Eddie said. "The Red Sox still haven't won the series, and homos are gays."
"Eddie," Susanna said.
"Hey," Eddie said. "Do you think it's easy being the one who left New York last and forgot to turn off the lights? 'Cause it's not, and let me tell you, I'm feeling increasingly out of date myself."
He turned back to Callahan.
"Anyway, that is what happened, isn't it?" "I think so. You have to remember that I didn't know a great deal myself at that time, and was denying and repressing what I did know, with great vigor, as President Kennedy used to say. I saw the first one, the first little one, in that movie theater in the week between Christmas and New Year's of 1975. He gave a brief, barking laugh. "And now that I think back, that theater was called the Gaiety. Isn't that surprising?"
He paused, looking into their faces with some puzzlement.
"It's not. You're not surprised at all."
"Coincidence has been canceled, honey," Susanna said. "What we're living in these days is more like the Charles Dickens version of reality."
"I don't understand you."
"You don't need to, Shug. Go on, tell your tale."
The old fella took a moment to find the dropped thread, then went on.
"I saw my first type 3 in late December of 1975. By that night, about 3 months later, when I saw the blue glow around Lupe's neck, I'd come across half a dozen more. Only one of them at Prey. He was down in an East Village alley with another guy. He, the vampire, was standing like this."
Callahan rose and demonstrated, arms out, palms propped against an invisible wall.
"The other one, the victim, was between his propped arms, facing him. They could have been talking, they could have been kissing, but I knew. I knew that it wasn't either one. The others, I saw a couple in restaurants, both of them eating alone. That glow was all over their hands and their faces, smeared across their lips like electric blueberry juice. and the burned onion smell hung around them like some kind of perfume.
Callahan smiled briefly.
It strikes me how every description I try to make has some kind of simile buried in it, because I'm not just trying to describe them, you know, I'm trying to understand them. Still trying to understand them. To figure out how there could have been this other world, this secret world, there all the time, right beside the one I'd always known.
Roland's right, Eddie thought. It's Todash. Gotta be. He doesn't know it, but it is. Does that make him one of us? Part of our quartet?
I saw one in line at Marine Midland Bank, where Home did its business, Callahan said. Middle of the day, I was in the deposit line. This woman was in withdrawals. That light was all around her. She saw me looking at her and smiled. Fearless eye contact. Flirty. He paused. Sexy.
You knew them because of the vampire demon's blood in you, Roland said. Did they know you?
No, Callahan said promptly. If they'd been able to see me, to isolate me, my life wouldn't have been worth a dime. Although they came to know about me, that was later, though. My point is, I saw them. I knew they were there. And when I saw what had happened to Lupe, I knew what had been at him. They see it, too. Smell it. Probably hear the chimes as well. Their victims are marked, and after that, more are apt to come, like bugs to a light, or dogs all determined to piss on the same telephone pole. I'm sure that night in March was the first time Lupe was bitten, because I never saw that glow around him before, or the marks on the side of his throat, which looked like no more than a couple of shaving nicks. But he was bitten repeatedly after that. It had something to do with the nature of the business we were in, working with transients. Maybe drinking alcohol-laced blood is a cheap high for them, who knows? In any case, it was because of Lupe that I made my first kill. The first of many. This was in April.
10. This is April, and the air has finally begun to feel and smell like spring. Callahan has been at home since 5, first writing checks to cover end-of-the-month bills, then working on his culinary specialty, which he calls toads and dumplings stew. The meat is actually stewing beef, but the colorful name amuses him. He's been washing the big steel pot as he goes along, not because he needs to. One of the few things there's no shortage of at home is cooking gear, but because that's the way his mother taught him to operate in the kitchen. Clean as you go. He takes a pot to the back door, holds it against his hip with one hand, turns the knob with his other hand. He goes out into the alley, meaning to toss the soapy water into the sewer grating out there, and then he stops. Here is something he has seen before, down in the village, but then the two men, the one standing against the wall, the one in front of him, leaning forward with his hands propped against the bricks, were only shadows. These two he can see clearly in the light from the kitchen. And the one leaning back against the wall, seemingly asleep, with his head turned to the side, exposing his neck, is someone Callahan knows. It is Lupe. Although the open door has lit up this part of the alley, and Callahan has made no effort to be quiet, has, in fact, been singing Lou Reed's Take a Walk on the Wild Side, neither of them notices him. They are entranced. The man in front of Lupe looks to be about 50, well-dressed in a suit and a tie. Beside him, an expensive Mark Cross briefcase rests on the cobbles. This man's head is thrust forward and tilted. His open lips are sealed against the right side of Lupe's neck. What's under there, jugular? Carotid? Callahan doesn't remember, nor does it matter. The chimes don't play this time, but the smell is overwhelming, so rank that tears burst from his eyes and clear mucus immediately begins to drip from his nostrils. The two men opposite him blaze with that dark blue light, and Callahan can see it swirling in rhythmic pulses. That's their breathing, he thinks. It's their breathing, stirring that shit around. Which means it's real. Callahan can hear, very faintly, a liquid smooching sound. It's the sound you hear in a movie when a couple is kissing passionately, really pouring it on.
He doesn't think about what he does next. He puts down the potful of sudsy, greasy water. It clanks loudly on the concrete stoop, but the couple leaning against the alley wall opposite don't stir. They remain lost in their dream. Callahan takes two steps backward into the kitchen. On the counter is the cleaver he's been using to cube the stew beef. Its blade gleams brightly. He can see his face in it and thinks, well, at least I'm not one. My reflection's still there. Then he closes his hand around the rubber grip. He walks back out into the alley. He steps over the pot of soapy water. The air is mild and damp. Somewhere water is dripping. Somewhere a radio is blaring, "Someone saved my life tonight." Moisture in the air makes a halo around the light on the far side of the alley. It's April in New York, and 10 feet from where Callahan, not long ago an ordained priest of the Catholic Church, stands, a vampire is taking blood from his prey, from the man with whom Donald Callahan has fallen in love. "Almost had your hooks in me, didn't you, dear?" Elton John sings, and Callahan steps forward, raising the cleaver. He brings it down, and it sinks deep into the vampire's skull. The sides of the vampire's face push out like wings. He raises his head suddenly, like a predator that has just heard the approach of something bigger and more dangerous than he is. A moment later, he dips slightly at the knees as if meaning to pick up the briefcase, then seems to decide he can do without it. He turns and walks slowly toward the mouth of the alley, toward the sound of Elton John, who is now singing, "Someone saved, someone saved, someone saved my life tonight." The cleaver is still sticking out of the thing's skull. The handle waggles back and forth with each step like a stiff little tail. Callahan sees some blood, but not the ocean he would have expected. At that moment, he is too deep in shock to wonder about this, but later he will come to believe that there is precious little liquid blood in these beings. Whatever keeps them moving, it's more magical than the miracle of blood. Most of what was there, blood has coagulated as firmly as the yolk of a hard-cooked egg. It takes another step, then stops. Its shoulders slump. Callahan loses sight of its head when it sags forward, and then, suddenly, the clothes are collapsing, crumpling in on themselves, drifting down to the wet surface of the alley. Feeling like a man in a dream, Callahan goes forward to examine them. Lupe Delgado stands against the wall, head back, eyes shut, still lost in whatever dream the vampire has cast over him. Blood trickles down his neck in small and unimportant streams. Callahan looks at the clothes. The tie is still knotted, the shirt is still inside the suit coat, and still tucked into the suit pants. He knows that if he unzipped the fly of those suit pants, he would see the underwear inside. He picks up one arm of the coat, mostly to confirm its emptiness by touch as well as sight, and the vampire's watch tumbles out of the sleeve and lands with a clink beside what looks like a class ring. There's hair, there are teeth, some with fillings. Of the rest of Mr. Mark Cross' briefcase, there is no sign. Callahan gathers up the clothes. Elton John is still singing "Someone Saved My Life Tonight," but maybe that's not surprising. It's a pretty long song, one of those 4-minute jobs, must be. He puts the watch on his own wrist and the ring on one of his own fingers, just for temporary safekeeping. He takes the clothes inside, walking past Lupe, Lupe still lost in his dream. And the holes in his neck, little bigger than pinpricks to start with, are disappearing. The kitchen is miraculously empty. Off it, to the left, is a door marked storage. Beyond it is a short hall with compartments on both sides. These are behind locked gates made of heavy chicken wire to discourage pilferage. Canned goods on one side, dry goods on the other. Then clothes. Shirts in one compartment, pants in another. Dresses and skirts in another, coats in yet another. At the very end of the hall is a beat-up wardrobe marked miscellany. Callahan finds the vampire's wallet and sticks it in his pocket on top of his own. The two of them together make quite a lump. Then he unlocks the wardrobe and tosses in the vampire's unsorted clothes. It's easier than trying to take his ensemble apart, although he guesses that when the underwear is found inside the pants, there will be grumbling. At home, used underwear is not accepted.
We may cater to the low-bottom crowd, Rowan Magruder has told Callahan once, but we do have our standards.
Never mind their standards now. There's the vampire's hair and teeth to think about. His watch, his ring, his wallet, and God, his briefcase and his shoes, they must still be out there. Don't you dare complain, he tells himself, not when 95% of him is gone, just conveniently disappeared, like the monster in the last reel of a horror movie. God's been with you so far, I think it's God, so don't you dare complain.
Nor does he. He gathers up the hair, the teeth, the briefcase, and takes them to the end of the alley, splashing through puddles and tosses them over the fence. After a moment's consideration, he throws the watch, wallet, and ring over, too. The ring sticks on his finger for a moment, and he almost panics, but at last it comes off, and over it goes. Plink. Someone will take care of this stuff for him. This is New York, after all. He goes back to Lupe and sees the shoes. They're too good to throw away, he thinks. There are years of wear left in those babies. He picks them up and walks back into the kitchen with them dangling from the first two fingers of his right hand. He's standing there with them by the stove when Lupe comes walking into the kitchen from the alley.
Don? He asks.
His voice is a little furry, the voice of someone who has just awakened from a sound sleep. It also sounds amused. He points at the shoes hooked over the tips of Callahan's fingers.
Were you going to put those in the stew?
It might improve the flavor, but no, just in storage, Callahan says.
He is astounded by the calmness of his own voice, and his heart, beating along at a nice regular 60 or 70 beats a minute.
Someone left them out back. What have you been up to?
Lupe gives him a smile, and when he smiles, he is more beautiful than ever. Just out there having a smoke, he says. It was too nice to come in. Didn't you see me?
As a matter of fact, I did, Callahan said. You looked lost in your own little world, and I didn't want to interrupt you. Open the storage room door for me, would you?
Lupe opens the door.
That looks like a really nice pair, he says.
Bally? What's someone doing leaving Bally's shoes for the drunks?
Someone must have changed his mind about them, Callahan says.
He hears the bells. That poison sweetness. And grits his teeth against the sound. The world seems to shimmer for a moment. Not now, he thinks. Ah, not now, please. It's not a prayer. He prays little these days, but maybe something hears because the sound of the chimes fades. The world steadies. From the other room, someone is bawling for supper. Someone else is cursing. Same old, same old. And he wants a drink. That's the same, too, only the craving is fiercer than it's ever been. He keeps thinking about how the rubber grip felt in his hand, the weight of the cleaver, the sound it made. And the taste is back in his mouth, the dead taste of Barlow's blood, that, too. What did the vampire say in the Petrie's kitchen after it had broken the crucifix his mother had given him? That it was sad to see a man's faith fail. I'll sit in on the AA meeting tonight, he thinks, putting a rubber band around the bally loafers and tossing them in with the rest of the footwear. Sometimes the meetings help. He never says, I'm Don and I'm an alcoholic, but sometimes they help. Lupe is so close behind him when he turns around that he gasps a little.
Easy, boy, Lupe says, laughing. He scratches his throat casually. The marks are still there, but they'll be gone in the morning. Still, Callahan knows the vampires see something, or smell it, or some damn thing.
Listen, he says to Lupe, I've been thinking about getting out of the city for a week or two. A little R&R. Why don't we go together? We could go upstate, do some fishing.
Can't, Lupe says. I don't have any vacation time coming at the hotel until June. And besides, we're short-handed here, but if you want to go, I'll square it with Rowan. No problem.
Lupe looks at him closely. You could use some time off, looks like. You look tired.
and you're jumpy.
Nah, it was just an idea, Callahan says.
He's not going anywhere. If he stays, maybe he can watch out for Lupe. And he knows something now. Killing them is no harder than swatting bugs on a wall, and they don't leave much behind. Easy cleanup, as they say in the TV ads. Lupe will be all right. The Type 3s, like Mr. Mark Cross' briefcase, don't seem to kill their prey or even change them. At least, not that he can see, not over the short term. But he will watch. He can do that much. He will mount a guard. It'll be one small act of atonement for Jerusalem's lot. And Lupe will be all right. 11.
Except he wasn't, Roland said.
He was carefully rolling a cigarette from the crumbs at the bottom of his poke. The paper was brittle, the tobacco really not much more than dust.
No, Callahan agreed. He wasn't. Roland, I have no cigarette papers, but I can do you better for a smoke than that. There's good tobacco in the house from down south. I don't use it, but Rosalita sometimes likes a pipe in the evening.
I'll take you up on that later and say thank you,
the gunslinger said.
I don't miss it as much as coffee, but almost. Finish your tale. Leave nothing out. I think it's important we hear it all, but...
I know. Time is short.
Yes, Roland said. Time is short.
Then, briefly put, my friend contracted this disease.
AIDS became the name of choice. He was looking at Eddie, who nodded.
All right, Callahan said. It's as good a name as any, I guess. Although the first thing I think of when I hear that word is a kind of diet candy. You may know it doesn't always spread fast, but in my friend's case, it moved like a fire in straw. By mid-May of 1976, Lupe Delgado was very ill. He lost his color, he was feverish a lot of the time. He'd sometimes spend the whole night in the bathroom vomiting. Rowan would have banned him from the kitchen, but he didn't need to. Lupe banned himself, and then the blemishes began to show up. They called those Kaposi sarcoma, I think, Eddie said. A skin disease, disfiguring. Callahan nodded. 3 weeks after the blemishes started showing up, Lupe was a New York general. Rowan Magruder and I went to see him one night in late June. Up until then, we'd been telling each other he'd turn it around, come out of it better than ever. Hell, he was young and strong. But that night, we knew the minute we were in the door that he was all through. He was in an oxygen tent. There were IV lines running into his arms. He was in terrible pain. He didn't want us to get close to him. It might be catching, he said. In truth, no one seemed to know much about it.
Which made it scarier than ever, Susanna said.
Yes. He said the doctors believed it was a blood disease spread by homosexual activity, or maybe by sharing needles. And what he wanted us to know, what he kept saying over and over again, was that he was clean. All the drug tests came back negative. Not since 1970, he kept saying. Not one toke off one joint, I swear to God. We said we knew he was clean. We sat on either side of his bed and he took our hands.
Callahan swallowed. There was an audible click in his throat.
Our hands. He made us wash them before we left. Just in case, he said. And he thanked us for coming. He told Rowan that home was the best thing that ever happened to him. That as far as he was concerned, it really was home. I never wanted a drink as badly as I did that night, leaving New York General. I kept Rowan right beside me, though, and the two of us walked past all the bars. That night I went to bed sober, but I lay there knowing it was really just a matter of time. The first drink is the one that gets you drunk, that's what they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, and mine was somewhere close. Somewhere, a bartender was just waiting for me to come in so he could pour it out. 2 nights later, Lupe died. There must have been 300 people at the funeral, almost all of them people who'd spent time in home. There was a lot of crying and a lot of wonderful things said, some by folks who probably couldn't have walked a chalk line. When it was over, Rowan Magruder took me by the arm and said, I don't know who you are, Don, but I know what you are. One hell of a good man and one hell of a bad drunk who's been dry for how long has it been?
I thought about going on with the bullshit, but it just seemed like too much work. Since October of last year, I said. You want one now, he said. That's all over your face, so I tell you what, if you think taking a drink will bring Lupe back, you have my permission. In fact, come get me and we'll go down to the Blarney Stone together and drink up what's in my wallet first, okay? Okay, I said. He said, you getting drunk today would be the worst memorial to Lupe I could think of. Like pissing in his dead face. He was right, and I knew it. I spent the rest of that day the way I spent my second one in New York, walking around, fighting that taste in my mouth, fighting the urge to score a bottle and stake out a park bench. I remember being on Broadway, then over on 10th Avenue, then way down at Park and 30th. By then it was getting dark, cars going both ways on Park with their lights on, the sky all orange and pink in the west, and the streets full of this gorgeous long light. A sense of peace came over me, and I thought, I'm going to win. Tonight, at least, I'm going to win. And that was when the chimes started, the loudest ever. I felt as if my head would burst. Park Avenue shimmered in front of me, and I thought, why, it's not real at all. Not Park Avenue, not any of it. It's just a gigantic swatch of canvas. New York is nothing but a backdrop painted on that canvas, and what's behind it? Why, nothing. Nothing at all. Just blackness. Then things steadied again. The chimes faded, faded, finally gone. I started to walk very slowly, like a man walking on thin ice. What I was afraid of was that if I stepped too heavily, I might plunge right out of the world and into the darkness behind it. I know that makes absolutely no sense. Hell, I knew it then. But knowing a thing doesn't always help, does it? No, Eddie said, thinking of his days snorting heroin with Henry. No, said Susanna. No, Roland agreed, thinking of Jericho Hill, thinking of the fallen horn. I walked one block, then two, then three. I started to think it was going to be okay. I mean, I might get the bad smell, and I might see a few type threes, but I could handle those things, especially since the type threes didn't seem to recognize me. Looking at them was like looking through one-way glass at suspects in a police interrogation room. But that night I saw something much, much worse than a bunch of vampires. You saw someone who was actually dead, Susanna said. Callahan turned to her with a look of utter, flabbergasted surprise. How? How do you— I know, because I've been toad ash in New York, too, Susanna said. We all have. Roland says those are people who either don't know they've passed on or refuse to accept it. They're— what'd you call them, Roland? The vagrant dead, the gunslinger replied. There aren't many. There were enough, Callahan said, and they knew I was there, mangled people on Park Avenue, one of them a man without eyes, one a woman missing the arm and leg on the right side of her body, and burned all over, both of them looking at me as if they thought I could fix them somehow. I ran, and I must have run one hell of a long way, because when I came back to something like sanity, I was sitting on the curb at 2nd Avenue and 19th Street, head hung down, panting like a steam engine. Some old geezer came along and asked if I was all right. By then I'd caught enough of my breath to tell him that I was. He said that in that case I'd better move along because there was an NYPD radio car just a couple of blocks away and it was coming in our direction. They'd roust me for sure, maybe bust me. I looked the old guy in the eyes and said, I've seen vampires, killed one even, and I've seen The Walking Dead. Do you think I'm afraid of a couple of cops in a radio car? He backed off, said to keep away from him, said I'd looked okay so he tried to do me a favor, said this was what he got. In New York, no good deed goes unpunished, he said, and stomped off down the street like a kid having a tantrum. I started laughing. I got up off the curb and looked down at myself. My shirt was untucked all the way around. I had crud on my pants from running into something. I couldn't even remember what. I looked around. And there, by all the saints and all the sinners, was the Americano Bar. I found out later there are several of them in New York, but I thought then that one had moved down from the 40s just for me. I went inside, took the stool at the end of the bar, and when the bartender came down, I said, "You've been keeping something for me."
"Is that so, my pal?" he said.
"Yes," I said. "Well," he said, "you tell me what it is and I'll get it for you." "It's Bushmills. And since you've had it since last October, why don't you add the interest and make it a double?"
Eddie winced.
"Bad idea, man." Right then, it seemed like the finest idea ever conceived by the mind of mortal man. I'd forget Lupe, stop seeing dead people, perhaps even stop seeing the vampires. The mosquitoes, as I came to think of them. By 8 o'clock, I was drunk. By 9, I was very drunk. By 10, I was as drunk as I'd ever been. I have a vague memory of the barman throwing me out. A slightly better one of waking up the next morning in the park under a blanket of newspapers.
"Back to the beginning," Susanna murmured.
"Aye, lady, back to the beginning. You say true. I say thank you." I sat up. I thought my head was going to split wide open. I put it down between my knees, and when it didn't explode, I raised it again. There was an old woman sitting on a bench about 20 yards away from me, just an old lady with a kerchief on her head, feeding the squirrels from a paper bag filled with nuts. Only that blue light was crawling all over her cheeks and brow, going into and out of her mouth when she breathed. She was one of them, a mosquito. The walking dead were gone, but I could still see the type threes. Getting drunk again seemed like a logical response to this, but I had one small problem. No money. Someone had apparently rolled me while I was sleeping it off under my newspaper blanket. And there goes your ball game.
Callahan smiled. There was nothing pleasant about it.
That day I did find manpower. I found it the next day, too, and the day after that. Then I got drunk. That became my habit during the summer of the tall ships. Work 3 days sober, usually shoving a wheelbarrow on some construction site or lugging big boxes for some company moving floors, then spend one night getting enormously drunk and the next day recovering. Then start all over again. Take Sundays off. That was my life in New York that summer. And everywhere I went, it seemed that I heard that Elton John song, "Someone Saved My Life Tonight." I don't know if that was the summer it was popular or not. I only know I heard it everywhere. Once I worked 5 days straight for Covey Movers, the brother outfit they called themselves. For sobriety, that was my personal best that July. The guy in charge came up to me on the 5th day and asked me how I'd like to hire on full-time. "I can't," I said. "The day labor contracts specifically forbid their guys from taking a steady job with any outside company for a month." "Ah, fuck that," he says. "Everyone winks at that bullshit. What do you say, Donnie? You're a good man, and I got an idea you could do a little more than buck furniture up on the truck. You want to think about it tonight?" I thought about it, and thinking led back to drinking, as it always did that summer, as it always does for those of the alcoholic persuasion. Back to me sitting in some little bar across from the Empire State Building, listening to Elton John on the jukebox. "Almost had your hooks in me, didn't you, dear?" And when I went back to work, I checked in with a different day labor company, one that had never heard of the fucking brother outfit.
Callahan spat out the word fucking in a kind of desperate snarl, as men do when vulgarity has become for them a kind of linguistic court of last resort.
"You drank, you drifted, you worked," Roland said. "But you had at least one other piece of business that summer, did you not?"
"Yes. It took me a little while to get going. I saw several of them. The woman feeding the squirrels in the park was only the first, but they weren't doing anything. I mean, I knew what they were, but it was still hard to kill them in cold blood. Then one night in Battery Park, I saw another one feeding. I had a fold-out knife in my pocket by then, carried it everywhere. I walked up behind him while he was eating and stabbed him 4 times. Once in the kidneys, once between the ribs, once high up in the back, once in the neck. I put all my strength into the last one. The knife came out the other side with the thing's Adam's apple skewered on it like a piece of steak on a shish kebab. Made a kind of ripping sound."
Callahan spoke matter-of-factly, but his face had grown very pale.
"What had happened in the alley behind home happened again. The guy disappeared right out of his clothes. I'd expected it, but of course I couldn't be sure until it actually happened.
One swallow does not make a summer, Susanna said.
Callahan nodded. The victim was this kid of about 15. Looked Puerto Rican or maybe Dominican. He had a boombox between his feet. I don't remember what it was playing, so it probably wasn't Someone Saved My Life Tonight. 5 minutes went by. I was about to start snapping my fingers under his nose or maybe patting his cheeks when he blinked, staggered, shook his head, and came around. He saw me standing there in front of him, and the first thing he did was grab his boombox. He held it to his chest like it was a baby. Then he said, "What'd you want, man?" I said I didn't want anything, not a single thing, no harm and no foul, but I was curious about those clothes lying beside him. The kid looked, then knelt down and started going through the pockets. I thought he'd find enough to keep him occupied, more than enough, and so I just walked away. And that was the second one. The third one was easier. The fourth one easier still. By the end of August, I'd gotten half a dozen. The sixth was the woman I'd seen in the Marine Midland Bank. Small world, isn't it? Quite often, I'd go down to 1st and 47th and stand across from home. Sometimes I'd find myself there in the late afternoon watching the drunks and the homeless people showing up for dinner. Sometimes Rowan would come out and talk to them. He didn't smoke, but he always kept cigarettes in his pockets, a couple of packs, and he'd pass them out until they were gone. I never made any particular effort to hide from him, but if he ever pegged me, I never saw any sign of it. "You'd probably change by then," Eddie said. Callahan nodded. "Hair down to my shoulders, and coming in gray, a beard, and of course I no longer took any pains about my clothes. Half of what I was wearing by then came from the vampires I'd killed. One of them was a bicycle messenger guy, and he had a great pair of motorcycle boots, not bally loafers, but almost new and my size. Those things last forever. I've still got them," he nodded toward the house. "But I don't think any of that was why he didn't recognize me. In Rowan Magruder's business, dealing with drunks and hypes and homeless people who've got one foot in reality and the other in the Twilight Zone, you get used to seeing big changes in people. And usually not changes for the better. You teach yourself to see who's under the new bruises and the fresh coats of dirt. I think it was more like I'd become one of what you call the vagrant dead, Roland. Invisible to the world. But I think those people, those former people, must be tied to New York."
"They never go far," Roland agreed. His cigarette was done. The dry paper and crumbles of tobacco had disappeared up to his fingernails in two puffs. "Ghosts always haunt the same house."
"Of course they do, poor things. And I wanted to leave. Every day the sun would set a little earlier, and every day I'd feel the call of those roads, those highways in hiding, a little more strongly. Some of it might have been the fabled geographic cure to which I believe I have already alluded. It's a wholly illogical but nonetheless powerful belief that things will change for the better in a new place, that the urge to self-destruct will magically disappear. Some of it was undoubtedly the hope that in another place, a wider place, there would be no more vampires or walking dead people to cope with, but mostly it was other things. Well, one very big thing." Callahan smiled, but it was no more than a stretch of the lips exposing the gums. "Someone had begun hunting me."
"The vampires," Eddie said.
"Yes." Callahan bit at his lip, then repeated it with a little more conviction. "Yes, but not just the vampires. Even when that had to be the most logical idea, it didn't seem entirely right. I knew it wasn't the dead, at least. They could see me, but didn't care about me one way or another, except maybe for the hope that I might be able to fix them or put them out of their misery. But the Type Threes couldn't see me, as I've told you, not as the thing hunting them anyway. And their attention spans are short, as if they're infected to some degree by the same amnesia they pass on to their victims. I first became aware that I was in trouble one night in Washington Square Park, not long after I killed the woman from the bank. That park had become a regular haunt of mine, although God knows I wasn't the only one. In the summer, it was a regular open-air dormitory. I even had my own favorite bench, although I didn't get it every night. didn't even go there every night. On this particular evening, thundery and sultry and close, I got there around 8 o'clock. I had a bottle in a brown bag and a book of Ezra Pound's cantos. I approached the bench, and there, spray-painted across the back of another bench near mine, I saw a graffito that said, "He comes here. He has a burned hand." "Oh, my Lord God," Susanna said, and put a hand to her throat. I left the park at once and slept in an alley 20 blocks away. There was no doubt in my mind that I was the subject of that graffito. 2 nights later, I saw one on the sidewalk outside a bar on Lex, where I liked to drink and sometimes have a sandwich if I was, as they say, in funds. It had been done in chalk, and the foot traffic had rubbed it to a ghost, but I could still read it. It said the same thing. "He comes here. He has a burned hand." There were comets and stars around the message, as if whoever wrote it had actually tried to dress it up. A block down, spray-painted on a no-parking sign, "His hair is mostly white now." The next morning, on the side of a crosstown bus, "His name might be Collingwood." 2 or 3 days after that, I started to see lost pet posters around a lot of the places that had come to be my places. Needle Park, the Central Park west side of the Ramble, the City Lights bar on Lex, a couple of folk music and poetry clubs down in the village. "Pet posters," Eddie mused. "You know, in a way, that's brilliant." "They were all the same," Callahan said. "Have you seen our Irish setter? He is a stupid old thing, but we love him. Burned right forepaw. Answers to the name of Kelly, Collins, or Collingwood. We will pay a very large reward." And then a row of dollar signs. "Who would posters like that be aimed at?" Susanna asked. Callahan shrugged. "Don't know exactly. The vampires, perhaps." Eddie was rubbing his face wearily. "All right, let's see. We've got the Type 3 vampires, and the vagrant dead, and now this third group, the ones that went around putting up lost pet posters that weren't about pets and writing stuff on buildings and sidewalks. Who were they?" "The low men," Callahan said. "They call themselves that sometimes, although there are women among them. Sometimes they call themselves regulators. A lot of them wear long yellow coats, but not all. A lot of them have blue coffins tattooed on their hands, but not all." "Big coffin hunters, Roland," Eddie murmured. Roland nodded, but never took his eyes from Callahan. "Let the man talk, Eddie." What they really are, is soldiers of the Crimson King," Callahan said, and he crossed himself.
12. Eddie started. Susanna's hand went back to her belly and began to rub. Roland found himself remembering their walk through Gage Park after they had finally escaped Blaine. The dead animals in the zoo, the run to Riot Rose Garden, the carousel and the toy train. Then the metal road leading up to the even larger metal road which Eddie, Susanna, and Jake called a turnpike. There, on one sign, someone had slashed, "Watch for the walkin' dude." And on another sign, decorated with the crude drawing of an eye, this message: "All hail the Crimson King."
"You've heard of the gentleman, I see," Callahan said dryly. "Let's say he's left his mark where we could see it too," Susanna said. Callahan nodded his head in the direction of Thunderclap. "If your quest takes you there," he said, "you're going to see a hell of a lot more than a few signs spray-painted on a few walls." "What about you?" Eddie asked. "What did you do?" "First, I sat down and considered the situation and decided that no matter how fantastic or paranoid it might sound to an outsider, I really was being stalked, and not necessarily by Type 3 vampires. Although, of course, I did realize that the people leaving the graffiti around and putting up the lost pet posters wouldn't scruple to use the vampires against me. At this point, remember, I had no idea who this mysterious group could be. Back in Jerusalem's lot, Barlow moved into a house that had seen terrible violence and was reputed to be haunted. The writer Mears said that an evil house had drawn an evil man. My best thinking in New York took me back to that idea. I began to think I'd drawn another king vampire, another type one, the way the Marston house had drawn Barlow. Right idea or wrong one, it turned out to be wrong. I found it comforting to know my brain, booze-soaked or not, was still capable of some logic. The first thing I had to decide was whether to stay in New York or run away. I knew if I didn't run, they'd catch up to me, and probably sooner rather than later. They had a description, with this as an especially good marker. Callahan raised his burned hand. They almost had my name. Would have it for sure in another week or two. They'd stake out all my regular stops, places where my scent had collected. They'd find people I'd talked to, hung out with, played checkers and cribbage with. People I'd worked with on my manpower and brawny man jobs, too. This led me to a place I should have gotten to much sooner. Even after a month of binge drinking, I realized they'd find Rowan Magruder and home, and all sorts of other people who knew me there. Part-time workers, volunteers, dozens of clients, hell, after 9 months, hundreds of clients. On top of that, there was the lure of those roads. Callahan looked at Eddie and Susanna. Do you know there's a footbridge over the Hudson River to New Jersey? It's practically in the shadow of the GWB, a plank footbridge that still has a few wooden drinking troughs for cows and horses along one side. Eddie laughed, the way a man will when he realizes one of his lower appendages is being shaken briskly. Sorry, Father, but that's impossible. I've been over the George Washington Bridge maybe 500 times in my life. Henry and I used to go to Palisades Park all the time. There's no plank bridge. There is, though, Callahan said calmly. It goes back to the early 19th century, I should say, although it's been repaired quite a few times since then. In fact, there's a sign halfway across that says, Bicentennial Repairs Completed 1975 by Lemerck Industries. I recalled that name the first time I saw Andy the Robot. According to the plate on his chest, that's the company that made him. We've seen the name before, too, Eddie said, in the City of Lud. Only there it said Lemerck Foundry. Different divisions of the same company, probably, Susanna said. Roland said nothing, only made that impatient twirling gesture with the remaining two fingers of his right hand. Hurry up, hurry up. It's there, but it's hard to see, Callahan said. It's in hiding, and it's only the first of the secret ways. From New York they radiate out like a spider's web. Todash turnpikes, Eddie murmured. Dig the concept. I don't know if that's right or not, Callahan said. I only know I saw extraordinary things in my wanderings over the next few years, and I also met a lot of good people. It seems almost an insult to call them normal people or ordinary people, but they were both. And certainly they give such words as normal and ordinary a feel of nobility for me. I didn't want to leave New York without seeing Rowan Magruder again. I wanted him to know that maybe I had pissed in Lupe's dead face. I'd gotten drunk, surely enough, but I hadn't dropped my pants all the way down and done the other thing, which is my too clumsy way of saying I hadn't given up entirely, and that I'd decided not just to cower like a rabbit in a flashlight beam. Callahan had begun to weep again. He wiped at his eyes with the sleeves of his shirt. Also, I suppose I wanted to say goodbye to someone, and have someone say goodbye to me. The goodbyes we speak and the goodbyes we hear are the goodbyes that tell us we're still alive, after all. I wanted to give him a hug, and pass along the kiss Lupe had given me. Plus the same message. You're too valuable to lose. He saw Rosalita hurrying down the lawn with her skirt twitched up slightly at the ankle, and broke off. She handed him a flat piece of slate upon which something had been chalked. For a wild moment, Eddie imagined a message flanked by stars and moons, lost, one stray dog with mangled front paw, answers to the name of Roland, bad-tempered, prone to bite, but we love him anyway. It's from Eisenhart, Callahan said, looking up. If Overholzer's the big farmer in these parts, and Eben Took's the big businessman, then you'd have to call Von Eisenhart the big rancher. He says that he, Sleitman Elder and Younger, and your Jake would meet us at Our Lady Falls noon, if it do you fine. It's hard to make out his shorthand, but I think he'd have you visit farms, small holds, and ranches on your way back out to the Rocking Bee, where you'd spend the night. Does it do you?
Not quite, Roland said. I'd much like to have my map before I set off.
Callahan considered this, then looked at Rosalita. Eddie decided the woman was probably a lot more than just a housekeeper. She had withdrawn out of earshot, but not all the way back to the house. Like a good executive secretary, he thought. The old fella didn't need to beckon her. She came forward at his glance. They spoke, and then Rosalita set off.
I think we'll take our lunch on the church lawn, Callahan said. There's a pleasant old ironwood there that'll shade us. By the time we're done, I'm sure the Tavery twins will have something for you.
Roland nodded, satisfied.
Callahan stood up with a wince, put his hands in the small of his back, and stretched.
And I have something to show you now, he said.
You haven't finished your story, Susanna said.
No, Callahan agreed, but time has grown short. I can walk and talk at the same time, if you fellas can walk and listen.
We can do that, Roland said, getting up himself. There was pain, but not a great deal of it. Rosalita's cat oil was something to write home about.
Just tell me two things before we go.
If I can, gunslinger, and do you fine.
They of the signs. Did you see them in your travels?
Callahan nodded slowly.
Aye, gunslinger, so I did.
He looked at Eddie and Susanna.
Have you ever seen a color photo of people, one taken with a flash, where everyone's eyes are red?
Yeah, Eddie said.
Their eyes are like that. Crimson eyes. And your second question, Roland?
Are they the wolves pair, these low men? These soldiers of the Crimson King, are they the wolves?
Callahan hesitated a long time before replying.
I can't say for sure, he said at last. Not 100%, can it?
But I don't think so. Yet certainly they're kidnappers, although it's not just children they take. He thought over what he'd said.
Wolves of a kind, perhaps.
He hesitated, thought it over some more, then said it again.
Aye, wolves. Of a kind.